You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mā haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Thomas. If I can, coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, asked about the ACT Party's stance on the conflict between National and NZ First within the coalition government. I also asked about the government's proposed changes to treaty principles and how they influence policy. I also spoke to postdoctoral fellow at the University of Otago, Christchurch, Jai Whelan, about nitrous oxide use and its harms amidst plans for a government crackdown. Thomas, what have you got for us today?
I talked to ITU Union Director Matt Danaher about TY Point workers taking industrial action this week, and I also spoke to Brake New Zealand Director Caroline Perry about Road Safety Week and how the campaign is encouraging safe driving.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai tiksin on 5395. Wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakehere rokiroki maronga i te pai, tukutuku o Erirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
These past few weeks have seen the New Zealand First Party and National Party trading jabs, with the crux of the issue beginning with the India Free Trade Agreement. The issue began with NZ First refusing to support the agreement, leading Labour to collaborate with National and back it to fruition. NZ First Deputy Leader Shane Jones expressed his concerns over the bill, making derogatory comments about an implied mass arrival of Indian immigrants. The comments were rejected by ministers in National, ACT, Labour, the Greens and Te Pāti Māori. Despite these criticisms, little has been done in response, and the coalition government remains intact. Following the incident, another disagreement was observed when NZ First Leader Winston Peters leaked emails that indicated a disagreement between him and Prime Minister Christopher Luxon over New Zealand's response to US strikes on Iran. The emails alleged that Luxon wanted to express support for the strikes, though New Zealand's official response only acknowledged them. Finally, the government has also been looking into changing how treaty principles influence policy. The plan is being criticised for its similarities to the Treaty Principles Bill, which was rejected in Parliament and by the public, who protested en masse in 2024 against the bill. The current proposed changes are not set to be discussed by Parliament until August. For our weekly catch up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I asked him about each of these issues, beginning with the party's take on discourse between NZ First and National. The India Free Trade Agreement has brought up some tensions in the government between National and New Zealand First. What do those tensions, I guess, feel like as the third coalition party from the ACT Party's perspective?
Well, look, ACT supports free trade, and I guess that's what you're getting into, because we believe that people get wealthier, New Zealanders get wealthier, by being open to the world and not by turning inwards and seeing all we've got in New Zealand as some kind of zero-sum game. New Zealand is a small trading nation, and free trade with other countries like India creates opportunity. It actually fosters competition in our local markets so that New Zealanders get access to more goods at better prices, and it fosters strong international relationships. And, you know, I think many New Zealanders would say there's never been a more important time for New Zealand to have a wide range of strong international relationships and not be too reliant on one country or another as trading partners.
Around the India Free Trade Agreement, Shane Jones, Deputy Leader of New Zealand First, made some offensive comments towards Indian immigrants. The ACT Party criticised these comments a fair amount. Does this affect the ACT Party's, I guess, broader stance towards partnership with NZ First in future?
Look, people can debate immigration settings, but they should do it seriously and without making whole communities feel like they're the problem. And, you know, we have one of the best and brightest Indian members of parliament in the ACT caucus, Dr. Paramjit Paramjo, who has studied it and tutored at Auckland University, has run her own business, and chairs the Economic Development Committee of Parliament. And to suggest that people like Paramjit and the hundreds of thousands of other Indian New Zealanders are somehow a problem is completely unfair and incorrect, and that's why ACT called it out.
Will it affect the ACT Party's stance towards, again, partnering with New Zealand First in future?
Look, it's up to the voters who they deliver in the election in November. ACT will work with the partners that we need to form a government. I think we've also shown we can work very constructively with New Zealand First and National on a range of policies where the parties have quite different offerings, but that's the whole point of a coalition. I mean, ACT wanted to reform and replace the Resource Management Act with a system based on property rights. We campaigned on it hard from 2022. We had a fully developed policy. That wasn't necessarily something that New Zealand First were interested in, but that's in the ACT National Coalition Agreement, and that's what I get to deliver in my role as Undersecretary for Resource Management Reform. So we just have to accept that the voters will decide, and each party will then negotiate about the policy that is most important to them.
You mentioned yours and the ACT Party's stance against those comments, and there's many other jobs where making comments like that would get you fired or certainly get you penalised within your workplace. Do you think that MPs should be able to make comments like this, or is there a lower standard for MPs, or do the rules change a little bit? What's it like there?
Well, ACT also supports free speech as a core pillar of our democracy, and there is the ultimate sanction. If the voters don't like what they hear from politicians and political parties, if they think that these people are not serious and aren't going to solve problems for them, they can vote them out. But we certainly don't want to be sanctioning MPs' speech. Remember, in the House, we have the privilege of free speech. Obviously, within limits, you can't call people a liar, you can't make ad hominem attacks on them. And outside the House, of course, you're subject to the normal defamation and slander laws that apply to any New Zealander. But ACT does believe in free speech, and we also trust the voters.
There was also an incident of disagreement between NZ First and National over the government's response to the US strikes in Iran, with emails that we saw leaked by New Zealand First. You've spoken before on the strikes as well. Did the ACT Party also take issue with Winston Peters' response?
Well, I think it's important for your listeners to know that within a coalition government, there's three different parties, and each party and their representatives will hold different views on a range of matters, and that's normal. But what really matters is that those differences are managed maturely, and what the public want is for the government to focus on the things that are important to them: the cost of living, better public services, safer communities, and making sure that, particularly for your listeners, once they graduate, there are high-valued and highly paid jobs to go to in the future. And ACT's focus in the coalition has always been on stability and delivery. We're just not interested in fueling coalition drama.
I also want to talk about the proposals to change the government's treaty obligations. What are these changes and why are they coming about?
Well, New Zealanders deserve laws that are clear about what they mean and what they require. And over time, Parliament's passed a range of treaty clauses with quite different wording and unclear legal effect. So the purpose of the changes is to provide legal certainty, because vague wording leaves far too much for officials and councils and courts to interpret after the fact. So the intention is that legislation clarifying what these treaty clauses mean goes through a select committee, so all New Zealanders will be able to have their say on whether they think that the definition is right.
There's been a pretty big criticism of this proposal, which is that it shares a lot of characteristics with the now off-the-table Treaty Principles Bill. The government's already rejected the Treaty Principles Bill, didn't make it past the first reading, and the public also had a pretty strong response to it, with the protests across the country. How would you respond, I guess, to that, the fact that the government is seemingly putting through something that has already been rejected twice?
Well, I think this highlights the underlying problem that ACT sought to resolve, which is undefined principles in law, which get to be interpreted by courts, by judges, by people looking at your academic score and deciding whether you get into a place on a highly competitive course because of your results or your ethnicity. All of these things need to be clarified so we don't end up in a situation where, you know, for example, if you're seeking healthcare, or as I put out, access to education, people are interpreting undefined treaty principles to allocate rights, allocate resources and allocate services. It's completely unacceptable to most right-thinking New Zealanders, and notwithstanding the fact that a whole bunch of people organised a heckle and came to Parliament to scream in our faces about it, the problem is still needs to be solved.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about discourse between New Zealand First and National, the India Free Trade Agreement, and proposed changes to treaty principles in law.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Lost Boys by The Courtneys.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
This week, Itu Union members at Rio Tinto's aluminium smelter at TY Point in Southland are taking industrial action after over 2.5 years of bargaining that has led to no collective agreement. Workers will take action for 4 days in an attempt to force Rio Tinto to make compromises and reach a fair agreement. They are asking for recognition of the conditions they work under and the contribution that they make for the company. With Rio Tinto securing the long-term future of the smelter until 2044, the agreement would have a large long-term impact. To discuss the industrial action and why bargaining has reached this point, I talked to Itu Union Director Matt Danaher. Now, Matt, can you give us some context and tell us what's happening at TY Point and why industrial action is having to be taken this week?
Yeah, well, Itu members have been in collective bargaining negotiations with the employer for about 2.5 years now. And obviously when you start off bargaining, you know, workers go with their sort of gold-plated agreement they want to see. And during the course of bargaining, you negotiate with the employer and, you know, you drop some things and you accept some of theirs and things like that. And the idea is eventually you come to an agreement around a collective employment agreement that both sides can live with. Unfortunately, what's happened here, and it's just worth saying this is a new collective employment agreement because it actually hasn't been anything like that at TY since before 1991. So this is an attempt to get it back. The employer has not, during the 2.5 years of bargaining, really made any concessions to what members have wanted, while members have made many, many concessions. They've had enough, basically. Members have had enough. And we know what Rio Tinto are up to because, it's, to be honest, it's something they do all around the world. They're a very anti-union company. They've got a history of fighting unions wherever they are. We're quite lucky in New Zealand that under our legislation they have to negotiate with us, but we don't think they're doing it in good faith. And if you look at their track record around the world, you will see human rights abuses, labour abuses, you know, the murder and torture of workers that have disagreed with them in the past, as well as large-scale pollution and all sorts of other things that they do. So, you know, our members want to send a message to their employer and say, hey, we're not going to go away. We are going to end up with a collective employment agreement here, and we can do it either the easy way or the hard way. Now, the employer has agreed to mediation, has asked for mediation on the 20th of May, and we think that's a good thing, and we intend to participate in that meaningfully, and we hope to come out of that mediation with a deal. And I just hope that the employer approaches it with the same sort of attitude.
You said there hasn't been a collective agreement there since 1991, and 2.5 years of bargaining is quite a long time for no result.
Yeah.
Is this the level of, like, exceptional anti-union behaviour you're expecting to continue? Is this out of the ordinary?
It is out of the ordinary, particularly in this industry. You know, most other similar work in New Zealand is covered by collective employment agreements. So it's quite an unusual attitude to take. It's not unusual for Rio Tinto, but it is unusual for this type of industry otherwise. And it's just, you know, it's ridiculous. It's just a sign they're not engaging in good faith. And, you know, we hope that this will, you know, will help bring it to an end. By showing them that we're serious, that members are serious, that they are prepared to take industrial action.
And looking at the numbers for the profit this company is making, a huge global company, like billions of dollars profit, is there any real reason why they shouldn't be giving this out to their workers?
No, there isn't any reason. It's certainly not financial. The members aren't asking for much, and the employer can easily afford it, as you've said. It's purely anti-unionism. That's what it's about. It's about frustrating their workers' attempt to have a collective employment agreement.
That was Itu Union Director Matt Danaher speaking to me about industrial action at TY Point and why workers are taking it.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B. Welcome back to The Wire. You just listened to For the Cold Country by Black Country New Road, and before that we had Fading Star by Phoebe Rings.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
Health Minister Simeon Brown last week indicated he'd like to crack down on the recreational use of nitrous oxide, commonly referred to as NOS or NANGs. Brown says nitrous oxide is becoming a serious public health concern. However, when compared to other recreational drugs in Aotearoa, it seems that the risk factor is relatively low. In addition, nitrous oxide is used for medicinal purposes fairly frequently, meaning its health risks in standard doses are well documented. To discuss the effects and risks involved with nitrous oxide and how the government could develop a more holistic response, I spoke to postdoctoral fellow at the University of Otago Christchurch, Jai Whelan. Today we're talking about nitrous oxide. The government is looking into cracking down on the use of NOS. To get us started with some context, I guess, for the listeners who maybe haven't heard of it before or aren't too familiar, what is NOS and what does it do?
All right, nitrous oxide, or NOS, sometimes called NANGs, it's a gas that is used all over the world in hospitals for medical procedures, etc., that when inhaled can produce feelings of euphoria, dissociation, kind of interesting hallucination, sometimes at really high doses or in combination with other substances, but it's really useful medically, obviously, because of that dissociation, so an ability to kind of avoid feeling pain. So it's really useful if you break your femur or need to readjust a dislocated joint or something like that. But obviously that associated feeling is something that people enjoy, and so they often inhaling it outside of medical contexts as well.
And the government has raised some concerns about, I guess, the health effects and the high use of NOS in New Zealand, or high in their perspective, certainly. What do you think of those concerns and of the health effects in particular?
Yeah, I mean, nitrous oxide in general is a relatively less harmful drug when you're thinking about all the drugs. Analysis of drugs within Aotearoa, the New Zealand Drug Harm Ranking Study, ranked it kind of way down the bottom in terms of the population level harm that it causes. This is perhaps not super surprising. It's something that we're using in hospitals all the time. You can use or consume some nitrous oxide and have essentially no ill effects of that. It's got a really good safety profile. It's an essential medicine. That said, if somebody's using a whole lot of nitrous or using nitrous very regularly, some harms can come from that, of course, and this is often related to its ability to inactivate B12 within our bodies, and so if you're doing that consistently, that can lead to degeneration of some of our nerve cells, which is where some of that really significant harm can come, particularly when it's regular or in really high amounts. The other area of concern, of course, is if people are consuming the substance when doing other activities where you need, some cognitive awareness or some alertness. And I know that's been of concern recently with some people ending up in accidents using nitrous while driving, for example. People have been seen consuming them via balloons while driving cars, which is definitely not a good idea. It can make you disoriented or dissociated, of course, and that's not something you want to be experiencing while needing to be in control of a vehicle. So I completely understand those concerns, but when we're taking a really, really big look at the country on the whole, nitrous is definitely not doing nearly the amount of damage that some of these other substances are doing, like alcohol, for example, which costs our country about $9 billion a year.
And so if it's not, I guess, causing harm on the same level as these other drugs, why do you think this change would be coming about now?
Well, it's definitely getting a lot of media attention, and there's a lot of stories out and about. And I'm not, I don't think it's something that we shouldn't be concerned about. If people are experiencing harm from drug use, that's definitely something that I care about, I'm concerned about, and I would want that to be reduced. I'm not sure that cracking down in the traditional way is always useful. There's many different concerns that can come from there, or unintended consequences that we need to be mindful of. We don't want to displace, use of a lower harm or lower risk drug into another area, particularly if people find themselves having a complicated or problematic relationship with the substance. There are definitely other substances that can be more harmful when used very regularly or in higher amounts. I think some of the suggested changes are reasonable, if you will. I think it's fair to say that the assumption about the larger tanks, for example, not having a use for whipping cream is probably a fair claim. I've never seen a business using the large tanks to whip, you know, mega amounts of cream. Of course, it's what those little bulbs are designed for, fitting inside those traditional cream whippers. And I think, you know, it is likely that people, or that those large products pose a greater risk of harm because just a massive amount of, or a relatively large amount of gas is contained within them compared to the small bulbs. And even the way that we kind of actually administer the gas from those larger tanks presents a higher risk than the small bulbs, for example. So I think taking those away is reasonable, but if we were to try and limit this access to it completely, we do run the risk of those other unintended consequences, perhaps. And I think that's part of a broader concern for me personally. Banning drugs outright or trying to get rid of them has quite clearly never worked. There's more drugs than ever before, they're more accessible than ever before. And so we need to be a bit more creative about the ways that we try to reduce harm in our communities. And I think there's other things that we could be doing around nitrous oxide in particular to, you know, increase people's awareness of its effects, how it works, the different things that we need to be mindful of, just a general kind of upskilling of people around making kind of informed decisions or mindful decisions about how they use drugs if they decide to do so.
Because over the last few years, we've seen nitrous oxide use increase, not just in New Zealand, but also overseas, right, in other countries, particularly in the US. What have overseas policies looked like to manage NOS use? And is that something New Zealand can maybe take some lessons from?
There's been some variation across the border. I mean, some nations have been relatively, haven't made many significant changes. You know, they have a very similar situation to us. Others have done, as we proposed to do, get rid of the larger tanks, put restrictions on how people are able to purchase, or how businesses are able to purchase those, and or how those products, particularly the small bulbs, are actually sold in stores, such as, you know, ID checks, limits on purchasing, for example, things like that, which I think are other things that we would maybe want to consider. And there's kind of things that have already been in place to some extent in the past few years. Before there was the clarification last year, there were some businesses that had waivers that people would sign, for example, not that they necessarily were binding, but to kind of try and navigate this kind of grey space that we find ourselves in within or with respect to this drug nitrous, which obviously has some uses in the home if you want a whipped cream, and obviously is also a medicine. So it's an interesting one because the substance has find itself in a unique position in our society, having all these different uses.
And you've written previously about, I guess, the value of drug education in addressing some of the concerns around NOS use. Could you talk a bit to that? What a government approach incorporating more education could look like for this, and maybe also other drugs?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons this came up for me is some research we did that was published early last year around nitrous oxide. We're asking people a bunch of questions, both people that had experience with nitrous oxide use and people that did not. And, you know, people across the board had relatively low kind of understanding of some of the things that we'd maybe like them to know or expect them to know, particularly people who do consume the substance. For example, that thing I mentioned about B12 inactivation, knowing that that is even a consequence of use and perhaps what we could be doing about that, or things to look out for if you perhaps are having a consistently low B12 level. You know, such as tingling in your limbs or periphery, numbness, etc. And so the fact that very few people know that but are still out there using it is of concern to me, and I think we could be thinking about how we incorporate that more generally, you know, whether that's campaigns, whether we need to be putting this into our high schools, etc. I think that's something we really need to be seriously considering. And of course, that's not just for nitrous, and, you know, nitrous is perhaps not even the most significant one that we need to be talking about more. But I think it's something that, you know, would absolutely be of benefit to our country. I know when I was at high school, I got barely any education around substances and had to go out of my own way, of course, to learn about them, and then more and more so finding that many people were coming through with little to no information. That remains a concern, although that is something that's changing. I think with the advent of, you know, the drug checking and its legalization, it's allowing for those conversations to be had more readily. There's more discussion of these things out in the open. And I think even the way the media is communicating about these things is changing as well. And largely they're more and more taking a harm reduction approach and including this information and, you know, links to other resources to find out more within their stories, which I think is a great way to get those conversations going.
That was postdoctoral fellow at the University of Otago Christchurch, Jai Whelan, talking to me about the risks of nitrous oxide and possible government responses. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Lalo o Le Maunga by Sanguine.
affairs current?
Richard, great question.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Decline by Proza.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
This week, the New Zealand Brake Charity has organised Road Safety Week. Sponsored by the New Zealand Transport Agency, BECA, and ACC, the campaign aims to raise awareness for driver safety and the continued high rate of serious trauma and deaths from crashes in New Zealand. With a specific focus on youth due to their higher risk of being in crashes, the campaign will have BECA and NZTA officials travel to schools around the country to run safety activities and teach kids about road safety. This year, the theme for the week is Road Safety Heroes, shining a light on those who help save lives on the roads. To discuss Road Safety Week campaign and how we can improve road safety in New Zealand, I talked to Director of Brake New Zealand, Caroline Perry. This Road Safety Week, can you tell us a bit about the campaign and how you're going to try raise awareness for major trauma caused by road crashes?
So our campaign for Road Safety Week this year is Be a Road Safety Hero. That is about recognising all of those who work to make our roads safer throughout the year, so our emergency services personnel, road safety professionals, and all of those who support people following a crash as well. And it's also about highlighting the part that all of us can play in making journeys safer for everyone, because road crashes are a significant cause of death and serious injury on our roads, and we've got a long way to go to make our roads safer.
And what are some of the outcomes you'd like to see from this Road Safety Week? Is it more of a general increase in safe attitudes to driving, or is there any particular policy change you're trying to encourage?
Road Safety Week is about raising awareness of the issues around road safety, and it's also about giving organisations an opportunity, and those at grassroots level, so things organisations like schools and childcare centres, companies, community groups, an opportunity to kickstart campaigns in road safety and raise awareness through activities that they can then take through year round, so that it's not just a 1 week activity. But there are a lot of things that we would like to see being done further in terms of road safety. We've seen some good things happening the last couple of years in terms of increases in enforcement of drink driving and the testing of roadside drug testing as well. But we've got a long way to go to reduce the amount of deaths and serious injuries on our roads. So we still need more things happening, investment and more things for improving our roads and roadsides and the infrastructure, having safe speed limits, continuing to improve the safety of our vehicles, as well as all of the things that we can do as road users to improve safety.
And what are the trends like for road safety in New Zealand? Have the deaths and traumatic injury from crashes been getting any better, or has it been getting worse?
Well, the last couple of years we have seen a reduction in the number of deaths and serious injuries on our roads. But that's still, last year, 272 people were killed on our roads. So that's still 272 families who are dealing with the aftermath of a crash, and many more who are dealing with serious and life-changing injuries. Serious road crashes account for almost half of all major trauma cases in New Zealand. So it is a significant issue for us. Data from the National Trauma Network also shows that young people, particularly young males, are overrepresented in trauma statistics as well, and are more likely to be killed and seriously injured on roads than older drivers.
Talking about how young people there are more at risk, is there anything we can do in particular to encourage safety for them while driving?
Yeah, so part of it is learning road safety from a young age and keeping those lessons going. But young people, young drivers are most at risk on New Zealand roads within the first couple of years of driving. So one of the things that young drivers can do is to use the Drive program that's available for new drivers, and also available for their driving coaches, whether that's a parent or a caregiver or another adult who's helping them to learn to drive. That's a really useful tool that they can use. And also about talking to your mates around road safety and the simple things that you can remember, but also remind your mates to do as well. Wearing a seatbelt wherever you're sitting in the vehicle, whether you're a driver or a passenger, keeping off your phone when you're at the wheel, staying below speed limits, not driving while impaired, all of those things are going to help reduce your risk of being involved in a crash or being killed or seriously injured in a crash.
What's Brake's point of view on the new policy going in to get rid of the full driver's licence test? How do you feel that will affect road safety?
We had some concerns around taking away the full licence test without having some other measures implemented earlier on. So we're pleased to see that hazard perception testing would be introduced earlier, because that's a really key part of learning to drive and being aware of what's around you on the road whilst you are driving. So that's the important part. But our concern with the removal of the full test is that some of the things that that full test did haven't yet been implemented at the earlier stages of licensing. So there could be a risk there that we lose a bit of the experience and the knowledge that young people are gaining whilst learning to drive.
That was Director of Brake New Zealand, Caroline Perry, talking to me about the Road Safety Week campaign.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Otago Christchurch, Jai Whelan, Etu Union Director Matt Danaher, and Brake New Zealand Director Caroline Perry. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.